So we're going to start by introducing members of the court. We have five members of the court here in the courtroom and two on WebEx. I'm Mike Havigan, the Chief Justice, and by seniority, we're going to jump to the WebEx.
Good morning, Justice Miller Lerman, present by WebEx. Thank you.
Thank you. Liam Castle.
Stephanie Stacy. Morning.
Jeff Funk, appearing by WebEx. Good morning.
Jonathan Papik.
John Freidenberg.
Thank you all for that. That also served as a test of the sound system. Pardon me just a second. I'm going to get the right sign-in sheet here. Ms. Andrews. We will have you arguing in just a moment. Please, while you are not arguing, keep your face mask on, even though you are definitely socially distanced quite well today. But when you are arguing, please take your mask off so that we can all hear and understand what you have to say. And Mr. Routh, you're on WebEx, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Very good. Appreciate that. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Ms. Andrews, then, good morning to you. Approaching, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Natalie Andrews on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Forrest Cox, who was convicted of murder in the first degree, as well as possession of a firearm by a prohibited person and use of a firearm to commit a felony. He was sentenced to life for the murder in the first degree, as well as a number of years of imprisonment that were to run consecutive to that life term in which he was convicted under the felony murder rule. Your Honors, I am asking that you reverse all of these convictions for a number of reasons, including that the cellular records were obtained pursuant to a search warrant, exhibit number 5, that was fully lacking in probable cause and particularity, so much so that to render official belief in its validity would be unreasonable. Not to mention that these cellular records were obtained exploiting the primary illegality, which was the search executed pursuant to Exhibit 1, an unlawful search that the state conceded to at the trial level, and thus is not in dispute before the court here today.
Seems to me that the state may be resurrecting that issue. Can they do that at this stage of the game?
Judge, I do not believe they can in this particular case. I think that there's a unique set of circumstances here. Certainly, I recognize that this court has addressed a similar issue in State versus Rolander Brown, as well as State versus Leandre James. However, there's a clear-cut distinction. When it comes to resurrecting, if you will, the primary illegality, the inquiry is about good faith. And the good faith inquiry is when the search occurred, not when the offense occurred. Therefore, the distinction is that in State versus Rolander Brown, at the time the search was executed, police were relying upon a statute that had, by all means, been deemed valid in this jurisdiction by State versus Erica Jenkins, and therefore Davis would apply, as would Kroll. They had no reason to believe at the time the search was executed that it was unlawful. Similarly, in State versus Leandre James, the first search occurred well before Carpenter is ever on the United States Supreme Court's radar?
Did this search occur before Carpenter?
No. It occurred 5 months after Carpenter. What's unusual here is that, okay, so in Jennings, when we have two searches and the law enforcement, same actually unit, homicide unit of the Omaha Police Department, here's word of Carpenter. They apply for and execute a subsequent search warrant. This is before the court in Jennings made a ruling on the suppression, and it was also prior to Carpenter being decided. So the timing is much different here. And what is also unique is that had the state not conceded search number one, pursuant to exhibit number one, certainly same analysis as Rolander Brown and DeAndre Jennings, because both Kroll and Davis would be applicable here. But neither is true, because the first search and its unlawfulness is not before this court. The trial court even noted in its initial order from November of 2018 that the state entirely failed to even raise the debate when it conceded to the unlawfulness of the initial search, and that because the state conceded, she was ruling in favor of the defense and the motion to suppress. So
I'm quoting from, I think, her order, and maybe she made a mistake, or maybe I'm making a mistake. She says the search warrant, although obtained prior to Carpenter, is not from none of the post-Carpenter. So is she?
I believe, Your Honor, if I may return to the
briefing.
What she also indicated within her brief and the critical distinction, or sorry, within her order, and the critical distinction here is while she noted that it was not in compliance with Carpenter because of the Federal Stored Communications Act, she indicated that nonetheless, the state failed to raise good faith doctrine, which of course they have the burden to do, and had in fact conceded to the unlawfulness of the search. So that's the critical distinction here. She certainly did mention Carpenter, and the trial court was well aware of the issue. And in fact, Jennings had been that trial court's case for jury trial as well, at a similar time frame. But what is so different here, and I'm made reference to her order, Your Honor, with respect to my argument as to why this is not, why the independent source doctrine was inappropriately applied, as well as why it was tainted by the primary illegality. In her November order, she makes very clear that she didn't need to rule on any of those issues because the state failed to raise them. So I would, although I cannot find the page.
So I may have a misunderstanding of timing on this.
Sure.
Is it correct that the initial search or effort to obtain records done under the Communications Act, was that before Carpenter or after Carpenter?
It was before Carpenter, by quite a bit. But
so
the
wouldn't the state have a good faith argument?
It would have had it done so at trial level. But instead, not only did the state not raise it, it conceded. The motion to suppress, or the suppression hearing, occurred in, it was either the end of October of 2018 or the beginning of November of 2018. Carpenter was published in June of 2018. So the reason why the inquiry here is for the good faith doctrine is November of 2018 is because state conceded the motion to suppress initially, did not raise good faith, The unlawfulness is not in dispute. It was agreed upon. That is what the trial court indicated. And so as a result, the only matter before the court was the subsequent search pursuant to exhibit number 5 unlawful, and was it tainted by the primary illegality? The timing is critical here, because otherwise we would have another case in which this court would be, of course, bound by its precedent in Rolando Brown and Leandre Jennings. But it's different because of when the timing was here.
Whether the state conceded it or not with respect to the legality of the first search, do we not still have the power to affirm the district court for any reason that's supported by the record?
Of course.
And so how would that figure in here if we look back and say the first search was not illegal? It was, at the time, pre-Carpenter, and the state could have relied on Jenkins. Can we not look at that as an independent basis to affirm supported by the record? And if not, why not?
No. Reason is because, although it's not said in my brief, but to answer your question, State versus Tompkins, in which this court reversed the Court of Appeals, who on its own raised the good faith doctrine with respect to research. The state has the burden to raise the good faith doctrine. It is not for the court to raise. And as a result, no, the court cannot retroactively now find that the good faith doctrine, and thus Jennings and Brown and in turn Cole and Davis, should apply with respect to the first search. It was conceded to, it was the state's burden, and it's not an issue presently before the court. And so then the issues become whether the independent source doctrine was properly applied, to which I suggest to all of you, it certainly was not. I think that there needed to be further factual inquiry made as to the
in regard to the independent source doctrine, what changed between the first search warrant and the second search warrant, or for that matter, original getting of the records for the Communication Act, and ultimately getting the records with the second search warrant?
Yes, sir. What changed was what the court would consider in determining whether there's probable cause within the affidavit and if particularity had been met. Again, what's unusual here is that exhibit number 5, which is the search warrant itself and the underlying affidavit for the subsequent search that occurred 5 months post-Carpenter.
Did the state change anything?
Yes, they added an entire page of language about the use of cellular phones in investigations on criminal matters, how they're helpful, what relevant information they contain. And the reason, Your Honor, why that's so important is because if you look at the underlying affidavit of exhibit number 5, it's 6 pages. Page 6 is only the county court judge's signatures, okay, and the date. So it's 5 pages of contents. That means 20% of the affidavit was brand new in the subsequent search from the initial search.
For example, the records that were obtained from the Communications Act?
No, there wasn't. But I think that in determining whether something is the fruit of the poisonous tree, certainly it's not simply a but-for test. The test is whether they've gained, law enforcement, prosecutors, state actors, have gained any advantage. And in turn, the independent source only applies if it was wholly unrelated. The two go hand in hand, because here, in the initial suppression hearing, so it's part of the record, what we learned is that upon obtaining the cellular records the first time, Detective Hinesley made two copies of the cellular records, one for Detective Kirkert to plot the longitude, latitude, towers within the Omaha area, and therefore determine if at the time of the homicide, the cellular phone was in the area of where the shooting occurred. Okay, so their advantage was that they got to plot all of this out, review the information, and then bolster their affidavit by an entire page, 20% in the subsequent.
Did they bolster the affidavit with any of that information, particular to the plotting that they had done because of that?
No, but I do not think that that is what is required. One, I refer the court to Murray, which I cite within my brief for the notion that this may need to be remanded for a factual inquiry into the officer's motivation. From the record though that you have before your honors on this matter, what you've learned is at the second suppression hearing, Detective Hindley indicates that he applied for the second warrant at the direction of the county attorney. So I do not think that we can say here that it is not the fruit of the poisonous tree. I do not think that we can say here that it is wholly unrelated and independent of the initial search. And finally, on that point,
so let me ask you, is it your position that if the state thinks that they've got a faulty search warrant in this kind of a situation, that there's no way they can ever go back? And
no, I don't think there's no way that they can ever go back. I certainly don't take that extreme position. For example, in State versus Leandre Jennings, as well as State versus Tillman Henderson, Tillman Henderson had to do with, was controlled by Riley, content-driven search. Jennings was CSLI. However, in both situations, law enforcement applied for the second search warrant before the trial court had ever made a decision as to the initial search warrant. The initial motion to suppress. That's not the case here. And in neither of those cases did the executing officer and authoring officer of the search warrant indicate, I was directed at by the county attorney to apply for this subsequent search warrant.
So why should that make a difference? The lawyer has looked at this and said, looks like we might have some problems here. Remedy for this is to go back and write why, just because the county attorney spotted this or the county attorney said we'll fix this, why should that make a difference?
The timing. It was the same week that the state conceded to the motion to suppress that the new search warrant was applied for. It was 5 months post Carpenter, and so there is no good faith doctrine here. Cannot say confidently, even from the record before the court, that the independent source doctrine implies, nor can you say that the subsequent search was not tainted by the primary illegality. And to go real quickly, go back, Your Honor, to your earlier question, why does this, even this boilerplate language matter so much? I'll tell you why, and it's State versus Michael Goins. Is because this.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the last.
Goins. G-O-Y-N-E-S, which was a case this court decided, I believe, in 2019. And the reason I bring that up, Your Honor, is because in that case, this court pretty heavily relied on not only the eyewitness accounts indicating, I know Goins, I'm Goins' cousin, I saw him do the shooting, okay? But there was no information about the cell phone being on Goins at the time of the shooting, near the shooting. There was no indication that Goins, to distinguish this from Henderson, that he was involved with another shooter so as to indicate that there may have been some sort of communication. In Goins, there was a heavy reliance upon the officer, who I believe was Detective Larry Cahill, again, Omaha Police Department, his experience, knowledge, training with cell phones, which I suggest to you is very similar to what Detective Hinesley used in Exhibit 5. And in fact, in the second suppression hearing in November of 2018, Detective Hinesley indicated that the homicide unit of Omaha Police Department meets often and with the forensics investigation unit to discuss matters such as carpeting. So they're all in contact. On that note, what I would add is, Judge, Your Honor, I certainly appreciate why this court has reiterated time and time again that the exclusionary rule is not an impulse. It's a last resort. I suggest to you, though, that this is the last resort. If you review this court's critical cases with respect to the search of cellular phones, nearly all of them have originated in Douglas County. Erica Jenkins, Tillman Henderson, Michael Goins, Leandre James. It's time that law enforcement is held to a higher standard. This is the last resort. A last resort that needs to be remedied by the reversal of the appellant's convictions so that the exclusionary rule can serve its deterrent effect. The last thing I would add, briefly address the Attorney General's argument, Your Honors, is that if you review the record, you'll see the adequate objections were made as to all the exhibits. The demonstrative, Exhibit 155, that was...
That was a pretty, I'll call it a large objection. Is that sufficient to cover everything that involved the phone records?
I think it was, and here's why, Your Honor. Not only were objections made to 148, 149, 150, but then what the AG omitted from its brief is that I was afforded a standing objection prior to Detective Herford's testimony on page 992. And then Exhibit 155, as Your Honors are all aware, was a demonstrative. The county attorney even indicated before offering it, this is for demonstrative purposes only. I am not asking this go back to the jury. I indicated in light of that condition, I have no objection. And this court held in State versus Pangborn, 286, or after 363, that of course, demonstrative exhibits are not substantive evidence. And when the county attorney did offer actual slides from the demonstrative, which was Exhibits 156 to 161, I again renewed the objection. So all of the matters, Your Honor, including with respect to the statement, have been preserved and are before this court on de novo review. So I'm asking this court review the appellant's, or reverse the appellant's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Val, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing Your Honor Chief Justice Hevekin, but it was audible, so I will proceed. May it please the court, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state. Cox basically takes issue with his convictions and sentences because of the district court's rulings on his motions to suppress. I maintain, as I did in my brief, that they have waived those issues for failing to object properly at trial.
What about the standing objection that was made? Ms. Andrews went over several other objections. There appears to have been a standing objection in the record for all of the evidence or exhibits involving the cell phone. What's your response to that?
Well, it was a continuing objection, page 992 of the record, but it was for a different witness. It was for the records custodian. And this court has at least three times said that a continuing objection does not extend from one witness to another. That's State versus Pope, State versus Casillas, State versus, I believe, Ortega, the unpublished opinion from 2016. So I don't think that standing or continuing objection had any validity when we're talking about Hertford's testimony as well as Exhibit 155. As far as it being a demonstrative exhibit, yes, that's true. But like I said, in the record, it was presented to the jury and it went over every call, all of the CSLI, and that was presented to the jury through the demonstrative exhibit as well as through Mr. Hertford's testimony. So while, yes, opposing counsel or the defendant's counsel at trial objected to the various exhibits itself, they did not object to the testimony, to the demonstrative exhibit. And like I said, under this court's case law, the continuing objection, as I understand it, was not effective. So we maintain that they waived it on the motion to suppress the cell phone records. However, I'll address sort of this court's questions about the good faith doctrine and sort of the procedural issues, I guess. And on the merits, I think, as Your Honor pointed out, Chief Justice Hevekin, Justice Papik, excuse me, their initial order that obtained the cell phone records, I'm not sure why the state conceded that it was should be suppressed, but it shouldn't have. The good faith doctrine would have applied under this court's case law pretty clearly, State v. Brown, State v. Jennings. And so I think this court could, since we're reviewing de novo, it's a question of law, and the record is sufficient to support it, affirm on an alternate basis that those records were admissible under the first order under the Stored Communications Act. And since
would that run contrary to Tompkins?
No. Tompkins, I think, simply said we have to raise it on appeal or at some level. And I did. I mentioned it in my brief, and then I'm raising it right now to give the opposing party a chance to respond. And then I'd also point out, a lot of the federal circuits that this court looks to on these Fourth Amendment issues doesn't care at all whether it's raised. It's simply a question of can this court review it on the record? Is the record sufficient to say good faith doctrine applies? And I think it is. We have essentially an order under the SCA before Carpenter came out, and I don't think there's anything factually that could have been uncovered or shown to dispute the good faith doctrine that they relied on the idea that the SCA was valid, and it wasn't until Carpenter overruled it that that turned out to not be the case. So I think the record's sufficient to say on the first order that the good faith doctrine applied. And in any event, I think that if you move to the second search warrant, there is, let's say we can't address the admission of the records through the first order directly.
Excuse
I think you can.
Me, this is Justice Miller-Lerman. May I interrupt? Because we have had cases, haven't we, with a second warrant, right? And it was developed perhaps to cure any deficiencies in the first. Can you speak to what we have done specifically? Thanks.
I know factually we had a couple, like the Henderson case, where I think, and my memory is not perfect on this, but I think this court okayed it through the second search warrant. And I think that's consistent with the idea that information, even if it's obtained perhaps wrongfully in one instance, doesn't mean that it's immune from being obtained later in a proper manner. And so the second search warrant here, I think, would have complied with that because they had, the probable cause affidavit that complied with Carpenter getting an actual search warrant. And so I don't think that there would be anything stopping the police or law enforcement from obtaining those records if they're not.
Counsel,
yes,
is there anything? Is there anything in the second the warrant, the request for the warrant, that came from the store communication warrant? Did they use anything gleaned from that to bolster their request for the warrant in the second occasion?
No, My understanding from the record and reviewing the exhibits, which you know I haven't had for a while, but all of the parties, I think, agreed below that the substance of the probable cause affidavit, as far as the underlying facts, were exactly the same. They did add additional stuff about the usefulness of, you know, CSLI, I guess, in the probable cause affidavit, but nothing that was obtained or gleaned from the actual cell phone records that they had already obtained. So I don't see any reason not to accord the second search warrant, validity. There is no poisonous tree in my mind. There's no fruit of the poisonous tree. It's completely separate from the initial order, which, you know, we maintain, again, was perfectly fine under the good faith doctrine. So I guess on the merits then, the second search warrant, you know, I think the probable cause was there. District court found it appropriately. You had basically the defendant linked to the crimes. You had the text message between the victim and the defendant's cell phone shortly before the shooting. You also had, acknowledging that he had a cell phone and his cell phone number. And then you had his interaction, I think, with the defendant at a cell phone store. So to me, it very clearly had probable cause to get those records, and that's what the district court found. As far as, like I said, I don't see any issue with the fruit of the poisonous tree part, because the initial order was fine, even if the state incorrectly conceded that before, and as well that nothing obtained from that order was used in the second search warrant to get the records again. So I guess in sum, I maintain that the defendant waived his ability to challenge this, the cell phone records, because he failed to properly object at trial. Yes, he objected to the cell phone records themselves, but the continuing objection was not valid for Herford's testimony or for Exhibit 155. And while Exhibit 155 was a demonstrative exhibit, if you actually look through the PowerPoint, it basically laid out everything. And Herford's testimony laid out everything about each call, the CSLI, where the defendant was located, et cetera. So I don't think that it was preserved. And if it were, the good faith doctrine, I think, applies to the records obtained through the first order. And if not, that the second order was sufficiently attenuated and or the independent source doctrine applied to allow those records in, since they were not relied on to obtain those records again a second time. As far as the other motion to suppress on the defendant's statements to police, again, I similar to the first motion to suppress, I maintain that they did not preserve it properly by objecting at trial, because, yes, they objected to the video interrogation itself, but they did not object to the testimony of the officer talking about it. And through that testimony, almost all of the incriminating statements from the defendant were admitted into evidence. So I think under this court's case law and specifically Ortega, they waived the right to assert prejudicial error. And in the alternative on the merits, I think the district court order did a pretty good job, went through, found a valid Miranda waiver, which I submit if you watch the video interrogation recording, you will agree, and that the invocation of the right to remain silent was not unequivocal, in that he stopped based on the district court's reading and in context, didn't want to talk anymore about the cell phone records, about it, quote, but then continued talking about everything else. So I don't think there was an unequivocal invocation there. And so the district court order, I think, properly overruled that motion to suppress. Unless there are further questions, I think I have said everything I have to say. And we would ask you to affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal, so that will conclude oral arguments on State versus Mark Cox III. Thank you both for your participation.
Thank you.
Ms. Andrews, if you would leave by the side door, that would be much appreciated.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rep.